This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
My name's Nicole and I'm from Brisbane in Australia. I was sick and tired of feeling sick and tired and had just begun yet another attempt at a non-drinking stint when I discovered the Over the Influence podcasts. The timing couldn't have been better. I binge listened to them all, joined the OTI community and have never looked back. If, like me, you've tried and tried to put down the plonk, but even after some success, keep finding yourself pulled back into the mire, join us in the OTI community, where we all share our stories of what works and what doesn't, and where we're currently at. Everyone's just so full of understanding and inspiration. In a few weeks, I'll reach a whole year without a single drop, and I can't thank the OTI community enough. You guys rock and make all the difference in the booze-free world.
So if you want to join us, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to another episode of Over the Influence, Series 2. It's all about the guests and our next guest. Well, you just have to wait a sec to find out about our next guest. I'll just give you a quick reintroduction as to who we are. My name's Sharon Hartley. Everyone calls me Shazza. I'm in the northwest of England on a tier 2 lockdown as we speak. Mum to 3 children, married to Paul, and today is my day 770 alcohol-free. Woohoo me!
Amazing! Woohoo!
Woohoo indeed! Freddie Bennett is my glamorous co-host. Freddie, just tell us a bit about yourself.
Hello everybody, I am Freddie, otherwise known as Freddie. I live in the northwest of the UK, currently on a tier 3 lockdown. So there'll be no socialising for me for the rest of my life. I'm 38. I live in Liverpool with my family. I was once a very hardcore, heavy drinking, heavy partying, live life supposedly to the full drinker. But then I stopped drinking almost 600 days ago and I realised really what living life to the full is all about.
Absolutely amazing. And we've got a grown-up to keep us both in check. We've got background Ben Anderson, who's our producer, but also alcohol-free producer. Ben, just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, hi. I was inspired by you two to ditch the booze. And I'm, 3 months, over 3 months in now. And I took the decision that I wasn't just going to do the 3 months. I'm now going to just keep going indefinitely because I feel great. Amazing. And I'm really happy that you encouraged me to do it. So thanks.
We've finally rubbed off on him. Rubbed up on him? No, we haven't done that. We've rubbed off.
Yeah, I've got some too.
You're not in my bubble.
I think I've gone red. Sorry about that. Anyway, I digress. So this series has been all about the amazing guests. Where to start with our next guest? I'm going to try and sum it up, and I'm useless at summarising briefly, so just bear with me. A friend of mine lent me a couple of books, and I went to return this one to her on a doorstep, and it was called Glorious Rock Bottom. This is a book written by Bryony Gordon. And I said to my friend on the doorstep, I said, I can't put this down. She says, oh, wait, I'm going to swap it for this one. And she gave me a book called From Rock Bottom to Sober Forever, written by Susan Laurie. What a story. I think I've read just about all the quitlet out there. And on some occasions, the quitlet it can be a bit glamorous. It can have a swanky cover. It can be glossy. This was nothing of the sort. It's not glamorous. It's quite hopeless in parts. It was a difficult read. And what struck me the most about it was written by, I hope you don't mind me saying this, an ordinary woman telling a really extraordinary story. So thank you from Over the Influence, Susan Laurie, and welcome to our podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on. I'm so chuffed to be here to be able to talk about my book, and I'm so flattered by the kind things that you've said about it. It means a lot.
It was one of those books, Susan, when I started reading it, and this sounds really cheesy, but it's true, and we only ever tell the truth on Over the Influence, I couldn't put it down. It was a real page-turner from the off. There's so many things we can start off talking about, but I think I'll just go straight in and say that you described yourself as a hopeless alcoholic, absolutely hopeless. Where did that start for you, Susan?
The journey to being a hopeless alcoholic started like most people who like a drink, and I wasn't anything out of the ordinary. I was a typical fun-loving student. I didn't drink, I wasn't one of these kids that hung around in parks when I was 12 drinking. It wasn't a late starter, but yeah, it was definitely when I was a student going out for nights out with my mates. I just found that when I had a drink, I felt like I had more confidence. And I loved having a drink. I loved how it made me feel. I was, quite wild and just loved having a laugh, having a good dance. So it started there. And I would say, through my 20s, once I got into my first career, it continued. And when I started working, I think, looking back, that I found that alcohol gave me a bit more confidence with my peers, but nothing again out of the ordinary. I just, used to find that when I was out and on company meetings and stuff, that a few glasses of wine would make me more confident talking to people. So it started there, and I used the word hopeless to describe myself because. At the end of the journey, I had tried everything to sober up. So in between, starting as a student, just having a drink to enjoy myself, to getting to be hopelessly dependent, there were quite a lot of years, and it was definitely in the early days so quietly progressive that I didn't even realize that I had a problem. Towards becoming totally hopeless, it really escalated at a very alarming rate. So it wasn't an overnight thing. This journey to being hopeless took a long time, and it was so subtle, and I imagine it as this sort of evil entity taking over my life. It was very sly and, worked with stealth that a lot of people around me didn't notice either. So it was a long, drawn-out journey, but it began, like a lot of people, just enjoying a drink out with their mates.
Out of interest, what kind of industry were you working in? And you talked about, having, getting that extra shot of confidence as such from alcohol. And did you find it was having some kind of negative impact on your work as well?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. I was out meeting doctors, educating them about drugs, and so I worked a lot in at first in GP surgeries and then in hospitals. So I was dealing with, I was talking to really successful, highly educated consultants in their specialist area, but in this was in the 90s, and a lot of that industry and a lot of other industries as well in the 90s. And a bit later, there was a lot of emphasis placed on entertaining. So I would have a budget to take doctors out. And I think that confidence thing was maybe even though I knew my subject, I knew the biology and the, all of the chemistry and stuff behind it. Sometimes I felt a bit out of my depth in terms of how I perceived these people because of my background. I'm from the Northeast, and I don't know, I was a bit mistaken in that, but I thought that it gave me confidence to be able to speak to these people that I perceived as being sort of highly educated, highly intelligent, even though, I was degree educated myself. I really did lack confidence. I see that now. Yeah, it was the sort of industry where my peers were very, very confident. I think I drank to sort of fit in.
There's an irony in there somewhere. So whenever we go to the doctors these days, almost the first question a doctor asks is, how much do you drink every week? And of course, all of us now that have been on this alcohol-free journey, we can't wait for that question because we can say zero every
it
week.
It feels so good.
There's always that... There's always that kind of tie up with the, obviously, you know, the medical profession, and obviously we all know that, you know, alcohol is not good for our health. But then also, I say, because I know a few doctors myself, and there's certainly an overlap, isn't there, in terms of also having to drink in that profession, or in a profession that engages with medics, to try and sort of get that confidence together.
Yeah, and like I say, I don't think it was just the industry I was in, and it certainly wasn't all based around doctors. We used to, you know, go away on company conferences, which a lot of industries did. You would stay up late drinking, when you're young, you can get up early in the morning and be in meetings and not have these horrific hangovers. But that can't go on forever. And, you know, eventually hangovers do get worse the older we get. That's just a biological fact. I don't know if it was because I was in that industry. I mean, I honestly couldn't say. Maybe I was the sort of person that whatever I'd done, I would have had a drink to try and fit in, or to try and be more engaging or more funny or whatever. But a lot of people, you know, worked hard and played hard, definitely. And the thing about alcohol is everyone that I've spoken to, whether they've developed a problem or not, you never ever think that it could happen to you. You always think that your behaviour is totally normal and that everyone else is doing it. And when you're surrounded by like-minded people who are having a drink, it never ever crossed my mind that this could develop into a problem. And I think because alcohol is everywhere, from cooking recipes to, you know, we associate it with every single celebration that we have, it just seems so innocent and it's socially acceptable.
No, I agree. And I think it's funny, isn't it? I like the way you described it, that it's almost like a bit of an evil force, because it's only when you stop drinking and then you start to see the world a bit more clearly, I guess, both, you know, literally and metaphorically, that you start to think, you know, all those things that I used to do, maybe that's not okay. Maybe that's not what everyone else is doing. And then did you find that a relief, or was it a bit of a hard lesson when you start to look back on your, you know, your drinking past?
When I stopped drinking, when I finally got sober, there was quite a period of time where I was almost in a daze. It took a while for the dust to settle and to be able to think, oh my God, what have I done? And looking back, one of the hardest things for me to deal with even still is the wasted years, like years that I just won't get back. And it is difficult to come to terms with. And sometimes that still hits me. There were a lot of behaviours. There was a lot of wasted time that, you know, it was difficult to look back on. I just thought, once the dust settled, once I got out of this daze, I just thought, I've had such an incredibly lucky escape. And, like, seriously, that I had to tell people about it because I had given up on myself. I'd sort of accepted that I wasn't going to escape it.
It's tricky because I know, I mean, I was certainly there as well, especially in those first early weeks when I stopped, and it almost felt like all the drunken mistakes and the skeletons in my closet were all coming out to haunt me. And you kind of sit there thinking, oh my goodness, yeah, there was that time when that happened, and that time, and that time. But I think in a positive sense, and as you say, I believe it was, you know, from one of the aspects of your book or your website, where you said, you know, it would have been a case of, you know, sadly, an early grave for you potentially. But the fact that you found the strength to avoid that, and you've got this amazing, you know, this amazing positive energy and this positive life now, I think it's such an amazing story. And the fact that, you know, there were those dark times, but the fact that you've turned it around and taken that control is so inspiring for people, I think.
Well, thank you. And you've just hit on something so important about the regret and look and having to face things that you've done. And I know that that is what keeps a lot of people drinking. When you've reached a certain level and you've caused, you know, so much damage and so much harm to relationships, dreading sobering up and actually facing that is definitely what keeps a lot of people drinking, because, and it's so sad, because what I found is that the people that really matter will be kind. But you can't ever imagine that, you know, when say you wake up and you and it all starts to sort of the mist clears and you realize you've done something really bad the night before. It got to the stage where I was just drinking on that, thinking, I can't even think about that. So I'll just drink until I'm unconscious again. It is very difficult sometimes to face what you've done, but people will be kind, and that, you know, that's one of the messages that I try to give people, like I was. It is really scary, but you'll get through it.
No, absolutely. I think on an even brighter side, Ben, can you just make a note of that Susan did say, I made an important
I
point.
I heard that. I heard that.
This could be a historical moment in Over
it's
the
never
Influence
before,
that Freddie does make an important point. So this is fantastic. Thank you. I absolutely agree.
I aim to please.
Susan, on reading your book, which, as I said, it is a page turner, and you are, as a reader, rooting for you. You know, of somebody, I was a daily drinker like yourself. Parts of your story resonated because you've shared a lot about your husband and your son, and that must have been really difficult to revisit and really difficult to rewrite. But I think what was so interesting was giving the perspective of not just yourself, obviously, living as an alcoholic, how the other family members had to live with you as an alcoholic. And it made for painful reading at times.
Yeah, because first of all, I got there, permit, you know, blessing to write it, because I really thought hard about it, because what I put them through was so painful. But what has come out from me writing the book, and like you said, it's only the people really close, you know, in fact the people that you live with, that see what's happening, and they become sort of almost like gatekeepers, and that information doesn't get outside the family. But my husband has actually read my book, and there were parts, you know, at the end when I was sort of almost drinking 24/7 that, you know, even he wasn't aware of. So this alcohol and alcohol dependence and alcoholism, that it absolutely thrives on secrecy and shame. It keeps people close and keeps, you know, it makes you keep these massive secrets as an individual, and then, you know, your very close family. And it was really difficult to revisit that, but I thought it was so important to be honest. My son hasn't read the book because he's 25 now, but I think, you know, his teen years were really blighted by my drinking, and we're incredibly close again, but I just think it's something that would be too painful for him. But yeah, the actual alcohol dependence, it relies on the fact that, you know, it's going to make you ashamed, it's going to make the family keep secrets from other people. So people outside an alcoholic's family often have absolutely no idea what's going on within that house.
Susan, your husband and son must be incredibly proud of where you are now.
They are. They are, because they see now through the, you know, the website, and the book has a Facebook page, and I put my email in the book because I thought, if I can just, you know, help even one or two, or, you know, a handful of people who read this, then it'll have been worth it. And so many people email me, and it makes them very proud, but it also makes me incredibly frustrated and sad, because I know it's quite a few years down the line now for me since I've had a drink, but I can still put myself in that position, you know, where you're so desperate and you don't know where to turn and you think, oh my God, I've tried everything and I still, you know, I've still fallen off the wagon. I can still be taken back there just by reading someone's email. But they are very proud, especially with, you know, things that have happened since the book was published, things that I've been involved with to sort of spread the word and to try and make, you know, changes to people's perception of people with a problem with alcohol, because I think there's such a stigma around it. And such
even
blame.
Around the word alcoholic, Susan, you know, it's not used a great deal. And, you know, you describe yourself on the book as a hopeless alcoholic. You picture that. I work in Blackburn. I see what, you know, are deemed to be hopeless alcoholics sitting on the bench at 7 o'clock in the morning, swigging whatever it is out of a brown paper bag. You wouldn't associate a hopeless alcoholic with being a decent-looking woman, holding down a good job, married with a son, you know, outwardly successful.
It's ordinary-looking people. In fact, there'll be people like I was at the school gates, you know, picking up their kids who've probably had a drink that day. You know, there are so many people who hide it very well.
I think you're right, Susan, in terms of that whole secret element of it, because I don't think any of us would naturally have described ourselves as secretive people or liars or anything like that in our, you know, our pre-drinking lives or our day-to-day lives. But it is amazing that effect that it has on you, from, you know, from someone saying, you know, for a loved one or a partner saying, how many did you have earlier? And you say 3, and you sort of forget to mention the other 5, or, you know, the going in the kitchen and pouring everyone a glass of wine and then pouring an extra one for yourself quickly. And all these little things. And I think it's not only the secrets we keep from our loved ones, but also the secrets we keep from ourselves. And I might be wrong with this, and it was maybe with my case, I think with a few other people, it was, I knew there was something wrong for a good few years before I took action. And you have those deep, dark moments when you're in bed on your own and you're thinking to yourself, you know what, this isn't okay. But then, as you quite rightly say, you get up the next day and you think, well, what make me feel better? I know, I'll have a little glass of something, and then all of a sudden your worries go away again. But it's only when I think we can be truly honest with ourselves that we can then start that journey forward into an alcohol-free life.
Exactly. And Freddie, you've said something else really important.
Yes.
Pardon.
Series 2, there you go, Ben.
Because people, you know, I get asked a lot, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Do you think I've got a drink problem? And, you know, you don't have to get as bad as I did, where, you know, it was 24/7 and just when I was awake, it was just to drink again, to pass out. It doesn't have to be like that. It's how you feel about alcohol that, you know, should ring alarm bells if you have got a problem with your relationship with it. And if you're, you know, being secretive about how much you're drinking, or even if, and one thing that I used to do, which I didn't realize, if I was meeting friends or if I was, you know, going out with my husband to a restaurant, or, you know, if I was going to I think I say in the book, or I'm not sure, a Christmas Carol concert, if you're thinking more about the alcohol that you'll have at that event than the people that you're going to be meeting, or the, you know, the lovely activity that you're going to be doing, you know, even if you're only going to have, say, half a bottle of wine, it's how you feel about alcohol in your head that says whether or not you have an unhealthy relationship with it, rather than, you know, you don't have to get as bad as I did to have a problem with alcohol. And, you know, it's so good that you knocked it on the head when you did. You know, you recognised that there was a problem. I think I knew that there was a problem, and part of my problem, part of what I'm trying to raise awareness of now, is that there needs to be more education, and, you know, when you go to see GP and stuff about alcohol and the treatments, you know, the fallback treatments, they don't work for a lot of people. So although alarm bells were ringing a long time before I got as bad as I did. I did really try to get sober a lot of times. The treatments that I tried didn't work for me. But I think because of a lack of education about it and because of the stigma, the blame was put squarely with me. You know, you're not trying hard enough. You mustn't want to get sober. You're obviously very weak. And sadly for me, it progressed. And then along comes the fear of sobering up and facing people. And then comes the hideous anxiety you get when you're withdrawing that you drink then to avoid. So, yeah, I wish, you know, I've wiped out so many years, and that there are things that I just can't remember, and it's tragic. You know, things when people around me didn't realize I was drunk and I can't remember them. And, you know, but you've got to try to not beat yourself up. And
no.
Yeah.
Talking there about the fact you weren't weak, because I've read the book, and you tried and bloody hell did you try, and you tried rehab and you tried AA, and these things didn't work for you, did they? If you wouldn't mind just sharing a bit more about that, about why maybe they didn't work, but then tell us about what finally did work.
I went down the very traditional routes right from the, as soon as I, you know, thought I've got a problem here, I need to nip this in the bud, I went to my GP and was sent for counselling. That happened several times. And I think with counselling, counselling is fantastic, and that, you know, people need to talk about their issues and it has its place. But I think when you've got something like a problem with alcohol that, you know, is, once it sort of gets its claws in, it's going to keep telling you that you haven't got a problem and keep tempting you back. So the problem with counselling for me was that, it, especially on the NHS, it's quite a long, drawn out process, maybe once a week. And in the meantime, you've got this addiction to something that is having a very negative impact on your life. So I tried counselling through the GP. I also tried Alcoholics Anonymous, not just once or twice, but, you know, many times, going to meetings. And I also, you know, went down the route of getting a sponsor and working the 12 steps. I don't want to knock any treatments, because, you know, they do work for some people. But for me, I found that a very negative experience, sort of almost giving it energy by saying I'm an alcoholic and regurgitating the negative and horrible things I'd done, and it, listening to other people's stories week in, week out about, you know, things that they'd done when they were drinking. And I just felt that every, you know, every meeting that you were sort of giving this alcoholism an energy by feeding it with negativity. And, you know, people might say, and people did say, if you think like that, you're in denial. And it's just your alcoholic head telling you, you know, putting things there to stop you from coming to meetings. And AA believe that the only way that anyone can beat alcoholism is to go to meetings for the rest of your life. And I think we know so much more about how your mind works now, and about, you know, positive thinking and rewiring your brain in a positive way, that I, you know, it troubled me that I was saying I'm an alcoholic every meeting and talking about negative stuff. So there was that. And then rehab, you know, again, maybe there are really brilliant rehabs out there, but I just felt like it was a very expensive detox. And, you know, when you've got a lot of people who all have individual needs, it is very difficult to give very, you know, intense individual treatment. And again, a lot of rehabs rely on, you know, when you've been through rehab, the only way you're going to stay sober is if you keep going to AA meetings when you leave. So I tried rehab more than once. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous more than once. I tried counselling, and it wasn't because I just put excuses in my head why these working. I really threw, you know, every time I went, I thought, if I don't nip this in the bud, I'm going to lose my husband and son. I'm going to lose my life eventually, you know. And so I did what I did want them to work. And then, you know, on top of that, I did all sorts of crazy stuff, different types of hypnotherapy, you know, some dangerous stuff that I paid for. I was just so desperate. I know what it's like to be so desperate that you'll try anything. And the sad thing is that when these things don't work, and it's still okay to say it's because that person didn't try or is weak.
Which is just awful.
It is. And yeah, because at the end of the day, you've got really, you're dealing with a highly addictive substance that is telling you all of the time, you haven't got a problem. You know, people are wrong. You can control it this time. Every time I stopped drinking, I would then be convinced, oh, I've sorted it now. You know, I can probably have a glass. I would convince myself, you know, I would have a glass of wine and enjoy it with a meal and stuff. And my drinking was never about that. It was just about getting drunk. But it tempts you back. It whispers in your ear. So, yeah, I tried everything. I really did. And it is progressive. And it right from the off, it sets out to get its claws in and not let you go.
It is. It's like it's like a slippery slope, isn't it? We spoke to Craig Beck a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and he described it as quicksand. And you sort of, you're sucked in before you even realise.
Absolutely. And then once you get so far down the line, like we said before, you start drinking because you just can't face sobering up. But not just because of facing people, but because the anxiety that somebody with that sort of a level of dependence suffers, it's not surprising that people take their own lives. So there's so much connection between, you know, alcohol dependence and mental health, because I know that I was drinking at the end because the anxiety that I felt, I just wanted to pull my skin off. I wanted to get out of my own body. It was so unbearable. So yeah, it does progress, and you do feel like you're in quicksand, and you just, like, you can't get out. And that is why I wrote the book, because I knew, and I still can feel how it feels to feel like that. And I know there's so many people out there that get to that point where they think, I can't beat this. And the thing is, you know, there's something out there that if you just don't give up and keep looking. But it is, it sounds easy, and I know it's not, but just never give up, never give up, no matter how bad you feel. And now looking back, because I can still imagine how I used to feel, no matter what life throws at me now, and it's, you know, it's me and my husband and son aren't like the Waltons. We still have our moments, and now that I've been sober a lot, or quite a few years, you know, I'm a mum again, a proper mum again. But no matter what life throws at me, I know I will never, ever feel as bad ever as one of those mornings or times when you wake up and you think, oh, my God, what have I done? What did I do? Who have I hurt? So, yeah, you can beat it, but it's not easy. It is like quicksand. I think that's a really good description.
I think that's so reassuring for people as well, Susan, because we see so many stories of people that have said, you know, this is it, I'm going to go and, yeah, this is the time, I'm going to go and do it now, this is my last time, and then they don't manage to make it, and they do have another drink, and that was me as well. I had so many day ones, it was unbelievable, and I'd be I'd give myself a talking to. I'd watch the YouTube videos and the podcast and read the books, and I'd be like, right, this is it. And then I'd end up having a drink again. And I think it's so easy for people to beat themselves up about it. But even the fact that they're trying, even the fact that so many people don't even recognise they're in the quicksand. I think anyone that says, hang on, I'm sinking here and I need to try and claw myself out. And even if they do end up slipping down a bit further sometimes, the fact they're trying and they're climbing and they're striving is so commendable for anyone. And I think you're such a testament to that, that even if you can try all these different things and it doesn't work, that the fact that you went back and tried again, we can have 100 failures, but all you need is it for it to stick once. And then that's it.
And again, not to knock other treatments, but you know, when you told, you know, say you've reached 50 odd days sober and you relapse and then, you know, you have to start again at day, this is my day one sober. And it sort of seems to totally rub out all of the good stuff that you've done. I think that, you know, this whole mentality about, you know, going back to day one, which does more harm than good for a lot of people. Because anyone who's trying to get sober knows that how easy it is to relapse, and as long as you keep starting again. But I would say, think about the last how many days you were sober. Don't just think they count for nothing, because they do.
We are just going to take a short break from this fabulous episode of Over the Influence. Hope you are enjoying it just as much as we are. One aspect of our community, aside from forums and our OTI chat and our blog and our Zoom calls, we've got so much going on. We host what we call a monthly masterclass. Now, this is where we invite somebody that's inspired us, somebody you might have heard on the podcast. It might be somebody quite influential in the well-being or alcohol-free world. They come on. It's exclusively for our community members, and spend an hour hosting a masterclass, chatting to you over Zoom. They're absolutely fantastic. And the feedback we receive from our community members is just incredible. We love them. If you would like further information about the masterclass and about what we do within our community, you can find us online over theinfluence.co.uk, or drop us an email, otihq@overtheinfluence.co.uk. Let's get back to the episode. I know we've talked a lot during this podcast, Susan, about you being defeated and terrified and alone and hopeless, but it's far from hopeless, isn't it? In terms of, you have proved that you can be that low and that close to losing everything, including your own life. There's always hope.
There's always hope. And if people take anything away from this, it's that there's always hope. And I mean that, and especially in terms of the people who really matter will be kind. I could get quite emotional saying this. The people that really matter in your life will be kind. And because that fear of facing people that you've hurt is so powerful. But there's always hope, and the people who matter will be kind. If I'd known that, you know, I probably wouldn't have felt as scared about sobering up as I did for a long time. And some people, you know, might not believe that I did reach the point where I did think I was just going to die. But I'm a great believer that inside us all, there's still that little flicker of the person that we were. And no matter how big a grip alcohol's got on you, it doesn't entirely put that out. And there were, you know, there were times when I was, you know, I can remember lying there in the darkness just thinking, this is it. And it just happened to be this one day when I'd run out of alcohol, and I knew I was going through the anxiety and stuff. And I didn't know where to put myself. And I went back onto the internet to try and find somebody. And I'm a great believer in things happening for a reason. That happened that day, you know, I was meant to find this guy that day. But I do think we've all still got that little glimmer of the person that we were there. And no matter how bad you get, it does sound too, like it's easy to say, but I just want anyone listening who's feeling that desperate, that there's something out there that will make you stop drinking or help you stop drinking. There's something for everyone, or whether it's a person or a treatment, you know, just don't stop looking. But it's such a dangerous and destructive drug. And I think it's so telling now that, you know, it's almost like the penny's just dropped, that, you know, with coronavirus, that they're starting to realise, you know, if we take alcohol out of this equation and we put restrictions on people buying it or drinking it, that the rules, people might be able to stick to the rules better, because no matter how law-abiding or sensible you are, if you've had a few drinks, all of your good intentions, you know, go out the window. So it's very... It's interesting that the penny just seems to have dropped, but it just shows you how powerful it is that, you know, because people are getting drunk, they're not social distancing.
I think briefly, Susan, somebody's going to be listening now and they're going to want to know what it was, what was the tipping point for you, you know, what helped you recover. If you could just talk about that briefly for us, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I found a guy called Tim, and he invented something. He calls it PS Tech. It's a technique that it's not hypnotherapy, but he did use some hypnotherapy with me. I was with him a whole day. And what he did first was he used things like regression and hypnotherapy to look at, you know, underlying issues that I might have. And I give examples of that in the book. But then right at the end of the day, we addressed the alcohol. So he sort of dealt with things that might have, you know, things about my confidence or whatever. But then he basically made me try to have a craving for this bottle of wine that he put in front of me, which wasn't difficult for me to do. And through this technique that he developed, that craving was gradually diminished in a very, very powerful way. And I spent one day with him. And after that, since that time, I never think of alcohol. I can be around people who drink. I can pour drinks for people. It just isn't important to me anymore. And a lot of people, you know, and I understand, think it's too good to be true. I'm not, you know, trying to advertise Tim or anything. He's a very unassuming, lovely guy who, you know, alcohol isn't even his main thing. He works with post-traumatic stress. He works with lots of really, you know, with eating disorders, lots of really serious issues. But I think it was just meant to be that day that I found him when I, you know, did a search on the internet. What I'm trying to get across when I'm speaking to the, you know, the powers that be is that I'm not trying to sell this one technique. What I'm trying to say is that they should be exploring lots of different treatments. It shouldn't be you go to your GP and he says, here's some counselling, or go to Alcoholics Anonymous. There should be so much research and money put into looking at alternative treatments. And that's what I'm trying to achieve now.
I think that's so true. And I must admit, I've had hypnosis in the past, not for drinking, but for my wide variety of other issues, should we say. But I loved it. It was like a spring clean for my brain. And I'd highly recommend anyone goes to, obviously, the right qualified and certified people. But I think it's a really powerful technique that so many people overlook. And it really highlights that, I think that's so true, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. We've all got so many reasons, we've got so much baggage, so much background, and so many different reasons why we drink and why we might struggle with drink. And so why should there just be one solution and one route that you have to go down? So I totally agree, there is hope, as we said earlier, and there is a solution for everyone out there.
I spent thousands on hypnotherapists as well, and what I'm trying to achieve, because of the stigma around drinking, that it isn't treated in the same way as with other illnesses. It's, you know, people can advertise and not be regulated. So people like me waste a lot of money, but we're also very vulnerable and can be taken advantage of. So I'm trying to get some sort of people aren't followed up after rehab. I want it to be a case where, you know, they're looking, are you sober after 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, in the same way that other treatments have a success rate, so that people running a rehab, yeah, we're regulated, and yeah, we follow up on our clients, and this percentage is still sober 5 years later. That just doesn't happen at the minute.
No, I think that there does need to be more research and more measurement and more regulation, because it is a lifetime change, as we say. It's not for 6 months or a year. It's about making those long-lasting positive changes in our lives.
Susan Laurie, thanks a million. It's probably one of the few episodes where we've all gone quiet and just listened to what you've had to share. As I introduced you, you know, to me, and please take this as a compliment, just an ordinary woman, but sharing an extraordinary story, and we thank you for that. And yes, your book does describe you as a hopeless alcoholic, but as you've illustrated throughout the course of our chat today, there is hope, and it's just utterly inspiring. So thank you for sharing your really personal story with us. We've just loved having you as a guest. Susan, just remind people where they could find your book and your social media if they want to read more about you and your story.
The website is soberforever.co.uk. The book's available on Amazon, and it's From Rock Bottom to Sober Forever. And I'm not embarrassed to say sober forever. I know a lot of people say you should never say forever, but I know that I can. So yeah, that's where you can find it, on Amazon. And thanks so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.
Hello, it's Ben from Over the Influence. You've made it all the way to the end of this episode, and we thank you greatly for it. I just wanted to quickly let you know that if you love Quitlet and want some kind of Quitlet on the go, then have you had a look at our Over the Influence blog? It's completely free, overtheinfluence.co.uk/blog. It's got listener stories on there. It's got articles about alcohol-free life on there, opinion pieces on there. It's really good. We're working really hard to keep it updated, full of fabulous sober content, because yes, you love listening to the podcast, but also we know that you love reading stuff too. Go and have a look, overtheinfluence.co.uk/blog. Have a good read through. There's loads of stuff now, actually, to go back to the back catalogue of our blogs as well, if you've never discovered it. And thank you again for listening to this week's episode. We love having you with us. We love shouting about sobriety. And of course, we'll be back same time next week. See you then.